Picture this. It's August of 1944, and you're flying a P-51 Mustang at 25,000 feet over Germany. Your top cover for a B-17 formation heading for a synthetic oil plant near Leipzig. The mission briefing was like every other briefing. Watch for 109s. Watch for Focke Wulf 190s. Know your escape routes. You have a mental map of every German fighter tactic you faced in the last 6 months. You know how fast they are. You know what they can and can't do. And something comes at you that doesn't fit the mental map. You see it for maybe 2 seconds. Maybe less. It's there and then it's not. Gone before your brain even finishes processing what your eyes just saw. No propeller. Engine pod swept back. Moving so fast, the silhouette barely registers as an aircraft. You key the mic and try to describe it. The other pilots on the frequency have no frame of reference. The controllers have no frame of reference. Nobody has a frame of reference, because nothing has ever flown like that before. I'm Taildragger. This is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Today we're talking about the aircraft that terrified Allied fighter pilots, the airplane that had generals in Washington losing sleep at night, and the machine that might have rewritten the final chapter of the Second World War if the man who ordered it into service hadn't also insisted on using it the wrong way. The Messerschmitt Me-262, the Schwalbe, the Swallow, the world's first operational jet fighter. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in your flying life. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, commercial, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story, and in aviation, we have a lot of stories worth telling. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. To understand what the Me-262 meant, you have to go back to the decade before the war, back to the 1930s, when aviation was still young enough that an engineer with an idea and a drafting table could change the whole trajectory of the field. Frank Whittle was a Royal Air Force officer who filed a patent for a turbojet engine in January of 1930. He was 23 years old. The Air Ministry looked at his proposal and told him thanks but no thanks. Too speculative. Whittle kept working on it privately, cobbling together funding wherever he could find it. He ran the first successful ground test of a turbojet engine in April of 1937. The Air Ministry was still skeptical. Across the channel, a German physicist named Hans von Ohaun had arrived at very similar ideas through completely independent work. He didn't know about Whittle. They had never met. But von Ohaun had developed a jet engine concept and brought it to Ernst Heinkel, who ran one of Germany's most innovative aircraft companies. Heinkel liked it, Heinkel funded it, and on August 27, 1939, just 4 days before Germany invaded Poland, a tiny aircraft called the Heinkel He-178 lifted off from Marienehe Airfield and flew on pure jet power for about 6 minutes. 6 minutes. Test pilot Eric Warzitz was at the controls. The world had crossed a line, and almost nobody knew. Willy Messerschmitt's design bureau had been watching. They had begun laying out an airframe in 1938 that could accept jet engines when they became available. The design was sleek and swept and radical for its time, but they needed engines, and that meant waiting on Junkers Motor Enwerk, which was developing the Jumo 004 axial flow turbojet. The Me-262 prototype made its first flight on April 18, 1941, but not on jet power. The Jumo engines weren't ready. Test pilot Fritz Wendel flew it with a piston engine in the nose, which tells you something about the peculiar reality of early jet development. They were building the airplane that would change everything, and they were flying it on the technology it was about to replace. The Jumo 004 engines finally finished testing, and on July 18, 1942, Fritz Wendel climbed into the cockpit at Leipheim Airfield in Bavaria, two Jumo engines idling, all checks complete. And here is where I want you to slow down and think about what this moment actually was. Every pilot who had ever lived knew what it felt like to push a throttle forward and feel a piston engine respond. The whole airplane shakes with it. The exhaust smell comes up through the firewall on hot days. The sound is a living roar that changes character with every input, every mixture setting, every change in power. You feel it through the seat, through the stick, through the pedals. A piston-powered airplane is a collaboration between a pilot and a mechanical creature that has its own rhythms and moods. Fritz Wendel pushed those throttles forward and felt none of that. No vibration, no roar, just thrust. Clean, continuous, relentless thrust. The Jumo engine spun up, and the Me-262 accelerated down the runway and lifted off and climbed away. He flew for 12 minutes. When he landed, the reports described the handling as excellent. The speed on that first flight exceeded 500 miles per hour. 500 miles per hour in 1942. The fastest piston engine fighters of that era were doing somewhere around 400 under ideal conditions, and that was pushing them hard. The Me-262 wasn't a little faster. It was in a different category entirely, a different part of the performance envelope than anything else in the sky. Word reached the Luftwaffe High Command. Word reached the pilots. And one pilot in particular needed to fly it. Adolf Galland was one of the most decorated and respected fighter pilots in Germany. A genuine ace with scores of aerial victories, a man who had flown every frontline German fighter in service, whose opinion about aircraft carried enormous weight within the Luftwaffe. In May of 1943, Galland flew the Mi-262 at Recklin. His description of that experience became one of the most quoted pilot statements of the entire war. He said it felt as though the angels were pushing. Think about that from a pilot's perspective. You have spent your career wringing every last knot out of a piston engine, managing torque, managing mixture and cylinder head temperatures, planning your tactics around the physical limits of your aircraft. And then you fly something that just releases you from all of that. Galland came down from that flight and went straight to his superiors. Get this airplane into combat now. The Mi-262 was so much faster than the P-51 Mustangs, escorting the American bombers, that it could execute slashing attacks and be gone before an escort pilot could even begin a firing solution. Put it in the hands of the fighter pilots. Before the daylight bombing campaign destroys what's left of German industry, here's where the story turns. And it turns hard. Galland made his case. Other senior Luftwaffe officers made the case. The logic was undeniable. Germany needed to stop the bombers. The Mi-262 could stop the bombers, deploy it as a fighter immediately on November 26, 1943. Adolf Hitler attended a demonstration at Insterburg in East Prussia. He watched the aircraft fly, he was impressed, and then he asked the question that may have cost Germany whatever chance remained to turn the air war around. He asked if it could carry bombs. The answer, technically, was yes. A small payload with modifications, but yes. Hitler had been fixated on a fast bomber that could strike the Allied invasion beachheads whenever the long-expected landing on the French coast finally came. A bomber the Allied fighters couldn't catch. He declared the Mi-262 would be his blitz bomber, a wonder weapon for offensive use. Galland and the fighter commanders were stunned. This was the most advanced aircraft in the world. It had the potential to end the bomber campaign that was grinding Germany's cities and factories into rubble, and the order was to strap bombs to it and send it against beachheads. What followed was months of argument. Galland pushed back repeatedly and at great personal risk, because disagreeing with Hitler was genuinely dangerous. Albert Speer, the armaments minister who understood industrial production better than anyone in the regime, tried to manage the politics. But Hitler was not someone whose decisions got reversed easily, and the development program stalled and shifted and was tied up in political maneuvering for month after agonizing month. Historians still debate exactly how much time was lost. Some say 6 months, some say closer to a year. What is not debatable is the result. The Mi-262 entered combat in any meaningful numbers as a fighter in the summer of 1944. By that time, the Allies were already ashore in Normandy. The 1,000 bomber raids over Germany were continuing without pause. The strategic situation had already shifted catastrophically against the Reich. The jet fighter was real, it worked, and it was too late. Now, let's talk about the aircraft itself, because the Mi-262 deserves to be understood on its own terms. The armament was 430mm Mk-108 cannons in the nose. These were serious weapons. Pilots called the Mk-108 a flying bathtub, which gives you some sense of the size of those shells. A short burst from four of those guns into a B-17 was catastrophic. The tactics Mi-262 pilots developed took full advantage of the speed, high-speed slashing passes from ahead and below, into the bomber formation, through it, out the other side before any gunner could properly track. Hit and run, every time. If an Mi-262 pilot got drawn into a turning fight, he had given away his one real advantage. The jet had to use speed or it lost everything. Some variants carried R-4M unguided air-to-air rockets under the wings, 24 of them. Fire them in a volley into a tight bomber formation, and the effect was devastating. This was a genuine bomber-killing platform doing things no piston-engine aircraft could match, but pull up a chair. Because the Mi-262 also had problems that don't always make it into the romantic version of the story. The Jumo 004 engines were temperamental in ways that could kill you without warning. The metallurgy of the time was not up to the thermal demands of sustained jet combustion. The critical turbine blades were made from inferior alloys because Germany's strategic metals were increasingly scarce. Engine life was approximately 25 hours before mandatory rebuild. 25 hours. Every combat sortie in an Mi-262 was flown with the understanding that the engines might simply quit. Throttle technique was critical. You could not slam those throttles forward, advance them too aggressively, and you'd get a compressor stall, a flameout. Sometimes both German pilots had to develop a feel for these engines that was completely different from anything in their piston experience. Smooth inputs, patient inputs. At low altitude and low airspeed, the aircraft demanded respect, and Germany was running out of fuel. The synthetic J-2 diesel that the Mi-262 required was in increasingly short supply as Allied bombing hammered the synthetic fuel plants. You could have the most advanced aircraft in the world sitting on the ramp in perfect mechanical condition, and if you don't have fuel, it doesn't fly. The Allies figured out the vulnerability pattern fairly quickly. The Mi-262 was fastest in cruise. On takeoff and landing, it was slow and predictable, and those jet engines were dangerously slow to spool up if you needed power in a hurry. Allied commanders started sending P-51s and P-47s to orbit over known Mi-262 airfields. Just sit upstairs and wait. The Germans called it airfield hunting. Think about what that means. The fastest aircraft in the world needed piston engine fighters to escort it during landing. The Luftwaffe ended up assigning Focke-Wulf 190s to fly top cover for their own jets during the approach phase. If that doesn't tell you something about the strategic situation Germany was trapped in by late 1944, nothing will. The Mi-262 pilot community was a remarkable group. Flying the aircraft required exceptional skill and exceptional discipline. You needed the fundamentals to manage a demanding airplane at very high speeds, and you needed the self-control to avoid the temptation of turning combat where the jet gave away its advantage. Some of the best pilots in the Luftwaffe ended up flying Mi-262s in the final months: Johannes Steinhoff, Günter Lützow, and Adolf Galland himself, who had fought for the aircraft for 2 years and finally got a combat assignment flying it. The unit was called Jagdverband 44, stationed in Bavaria in the closing weeks. Among them, these pilots had accumulated something close to 1,000 aerial victories in piston aircraft. Now they were flying jets against a force that had already won the war. Steinhoff had an Mi-262 crash on takeoff in April of 1945. He survived, badly burned, disfigured. He made it to the end of the war and went on to become one of the founders of the West German Air Force after Germany rebuilt itself. The final tally is difficult to pin down precisely. Germany produced roughly 1,400 Mi-262s during the war. How many actually flew combat is a much smaller number. Somewhere around 300 were operational at any given time, accounting for losses in fuel shortages and the steady bombing of production facilities. The aircraft destroyed somewhere between 500 and 600 Allied planes during its brief combat career. A genuine threat, but against a force flying thousands of sorties a day with inexhaustible replacement aircraft and pilots, it was not enough. After the war, the Mi-262 became the most studied aircraft on the planet. American teams arrived at German airfields and found intact examples. British teams did the same. The Soviets took what they could find. Operation Paperclip, the American program that brought German scientists to the United States, captured some of the men who had designed and built these aircraft. Their knowledge flowed directly into post-war jet development. The swept-wing research done by German aerodynamicists influenced the shape of American jets for decades. Some of those engineers ended up working for American aerospace companies. Some helped put Americans in space. There are surviving Mi-262s in museums today. The National Air and Space Museum has one at the Udvar Hazy Center out near Dulles. The Royal Air Force Museum in Cosford has one. And there's a project that built flying reproductions using period-accurate construction methods. These aircraft have appeared at air shows, including EAA Venture at Oshkosh. If you have never stood on the Oshkosh flight line and watched a recreation of the Mi-262 rotate off that runway, that is something to put on your list. Because what you were watching in that moment is not just a warbird, you are watching the threshold, the before and after line of aviation history. Fritz Wendel pushed those throttles forward in Bavaria in 1942 and crossed it. Everything that came after, every turbine ever built, every commercial airliner you have ever stepped onto, is downstream of that moment. We live in a world of jets. And the Mi-262 is where that world began to take its shape. The tragedy of the aircraft is inseparable from the tragedy of the regime that built it. The engineers and the pilots were, many of them, gifted and dedicated aviators who happened to be born in Germany at the wrong time in history. The knowledge outlasted the war. The aircraft outlasted the war too, at least in the museums and in the reproductions. Standing next to an Mi-262 in a hangar, looking at those swept engine nacelles and that narrow fuselage, imagining what it sounded like screaming over a Bavarian airfield in the summer of 1944, you feel the weight of what it was, what it almost was, and what it ultimately became. The first jet age, right there in that airframe. Much of what I've covered today draws on Alfred Price's research into the Luftwaffe Air War, documentation from the National Museum of the United States Air Force, and the engineering histories around the Jumo 004 program. There's a lot more on the aircraft and the era at radiohangar.com. I'm Tail Dragger. There was only one first jet fighter. Now you know its story.